invite you to join me in welcoming Professor Gilbert Mailand.
Thank you very much, Chuck, for a too generous introduction. So I do wish my children could have heard it, so that I could get just a little respect sometimes. There's a story, probably just apocryphal, about a governor of New York back rather early in the 20th century, who was going to make a visit to the penitentiary at Sing Sing, which at the time was the state's only maximum security prison. And he got there and was going to speak to the inmates, and got there, looked out at his audience, and realized, you know, it's kind of hard to get started sometimes. He didn't know quite how to start. Often when he would begin his talks, he would just start by saying, "My friends." He didn't know if that was quite the right way to start that talk. Sometimes he would look out at his audience and he would say, "My fellow Democrats." But again, you know, he didn't know if that was quite the right way. So after this sort of awkward pause, he finally just looked at his audience and he said, "I'm so glad to see you here." As I am to see you here, not entirely a captive audience, I hope, though maybe some of you a little captive, I understand how that works. I am pleased to be here, pleased to have this opportunity to talk with you. How exactly we schedule this on the evening of the NCAA tournament championship game, I'm not quite sure. I usually pay attention to things like that, but we will get done in time to see Illinois' victory in that game. Let me start by putting before you just two short sentences from authors whom I'm also going to quote at a little more length later on. But for now, I give you just these two sentences, which, if you really think them through, actually gives you, in brief form, heading, what it is that I'm going to be trying to suggest. One of them comes from C.S. Lewis. Seems as if I needed from Lewis for the occasion, from his one of his fantasies from That Hideous Strength, in which one of the characters says at one point, "I happen to believe that you can't study men, you can only get to know them," which is quite a different thing. That's the one sentence. And the other, from the biologist Stephen Jay Gould, the sentence, "So organisms must be explained as organisms and not as a summation of genes." As I say, if you really think those, all I'm in a sense going to be trying to do is make sense out of those statements before I'm done. You may decide that I should have just read you the sentences and shut up, but I'm going to, in order to collect my honorarium, go on a little longer here. And basically, I'm going to try to do three things. I mean, roughly the outline of where I'm headed is this, and I'll try to make the stage as clear. I'm going to first try to depict a way that we have begun to think of human beings, to understand human beings, as collections of component parts, characterizing the higher in terms of the lower. I'm going to try to sort of spell that out just a little bit. Second, I'm going to suggest that this way of thinking, though we generally think of it as a scientific way of thinking, and it is in many respects a scientific way of thinking, is not just that, but that in fact there's a sort of mythic quality to this this way of thinking, and we won't fully understand its significance unless we see that other angle on it. And then third, at the end, I'll take a brief stab at just saying a little bit about what a different way of thinking about human beings would be, though I'll very quickly be beyond my depth. I mean, I'll tell you about what I can say, and you can do better somewhere down the road. You get really good, you can send it to me, and we'll jointly publish it under both our names. Okay, so first let me try to start on this way of understanding human beings. I begin with some sentences from Ernest Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea. "The water and watched the lines that went straight down into the dark of the water. He kept them straighter than anyone did, so that at each level in the darkness of the stream, there would be a bait waiting exactly where he wished it to be for any fish that swam there. No understanding of it, and I am not sure that I believe in it. Perhaps it was a sin to kill the fish. He urinated outside the shack and then went up the road to wake the boy. He was shivering with the morning cold. Then he was sorry for the great fish that had nothing to eat, and his determination to kill him never relaxed in his sorrow for him. How many people will he feed, he thought, but are they worthy to eat him? The saddest thing I ever saw with them, the old man thought. The boy was sad, too, and we begged her pardon and butchered her promptly. The boy did not go down. He had been there before, and one of the fishermen was looking after the skiff for him. Prose, if you read some Hemingway, is generally regarded as very clear and straightforward. I mean, it's a very concise, clear kind of prose. And I suspect that any single sentence in that passage that I just read to you was simple and transparent to you. I also suspect that the whole of the passage made almost no sense at all. And there's a reason for that. The sentences that I read drawn from pages 29, 104, 22, 74, 48, and 123 in that order. So if it doesn't make a lot of sense, you really don't have to feel inferior. Now, one of the great blessings of the computer age, we are sometimes told, is that you can move sentences or even whole paragraphs around with ease. You know, I used to say write a good first draft, but you don't have to do that. You just kind of move the parts. You needn't really have a thesis and its accompanying arguments worked out when you sit down to write a paper. Just write and then move the pieces around later. It's as if the argument of the paper were somehow built up from below, from words, phrases, and sentences moved around and recombined. As if a thesis would just emerge without an organizing intelligence and authorial perspective at work from the outset. As if we could explain what is lower, the argument of the paper, without what is higher, the author conceives the argument. You know, those of you who are teachers have probably read a paper or two like that over the years. None of you students, though, have ever written them, I'm sure. Now, my thesis, in a sense, tonight is going to be that we ought not make a similar mistake when we think about human beings and our genes, our genetic inheritance. Think of the image that's at work in this passage that I'll read you. It's actually a frequently quoted passage in the bioethics literature from a guy named Thomas Eisner, a biologist from Cornell. Eisner wrote at one point, "As a consequence of recent advances in genetic engineering, a biological species must be viewed as a depository of genes that are potentially transferable. A species is not merely a hardbound volume of the Library of Nature. It is also a loose-leaf book whose individual pages, the genes, might be available for selective transfer and modification of other species." Analogy, the kind of loose-leaf book analogy that Eisner uses, the philosopher Mary Midgley commented, "The idea of improving books by splicing in bits of other books is not seductive, because in books, as in organisms, ignoring the context usually produces nonsense." Now, I have tried to provide a humble illustration of this by splicing together sentences from different pages of just one book, producing thereby something largely unintelligible for you. And if you just let your imaginations roam a bit, we can imagine that I might, in addition to The Old Man and the Sea, have spliced in sentences from, say, Anna Karenina and A Christmas Carol, producing thereby something that we wouldn't probably even know how to name. We wouldn't know what to call what I'd produced. And the problem with doing this is not only, as Midgley suggests, that we completely ignore the context, that's part of it, but it goes a little deeper. That sort of image of a book ignores the presence of an authorial hand. It ignores the fact that a book is not just the sum of a number of words, sentences, or paragraphs. The book is a whole, with its own integrity, at least if it's any good at all. It is that. The thought was first suggested to me, and I mean, the truth is, it just occurred to me one day about 4 years ago. Suggested to me by one of the findings of the Human Genome Project, a project, you know, on which our government spent a great deal of money and which went on for over a decade, the mapping and sequencing of the human genetic inheritance. And in February of 2001, when the completion of that project by two groups of researchers was announced, there was a particular finding that got a lot of attention in news articles. You could go back and look, and I believe you'd see it there. And it was pointed to as a sort of surprise, something that had not been expected. We were told that the number of genes, the total number of genes in the human genome, had turned out to be surprisingly small. For example, at the time the initial findings were announced, it was said that human beings have at most perhaps twice as many genes as the humble roundworm, and that the degree of sequence divergence between human and chimpanzee genomes is, in fact, quite small. And that was thought to be surprising, considering the complexity of the human being in comparison to roundworms and even in comparison to the chimpanzee. It seemed surprising that, relatively speaking, much less complex organisms wouldn't have far fewer genes than more complex organisms, such as human beings. More recently, in fact, in 2004, they downsized the count even more, so that it appears now that the count for humans is 20 to 25,000 genes. That's the latest figure given, which doesn't put us very far ahead of that roundworm in terms of the total number of genes. As I say, this was always presented as something surprising. And what I found myself thinking about is, why would that be surprising? How am I thinking about beings if I'm surprised to be told that? Part of the answer is that it's surprising if you assume that the complexity, that what makes a higher being higher, the complexity of a higher being, is somehow built up and explained in terms of lower component parts. If that's what you think, then the more complex being ought to have a lot more parts, sort of. So that if we explain the higher in terms of the lower, it makes a certain sense to suppose that a relatively complex being would need lots of component parts, at least by comparison with a less complex being. And one might argue, of course, that the Human Genome Project is, as historian of science Alfred Tauber put it, the ultimate product of an extreme reductionist vision of biology that has held that to understand better, one need only go smaller, get to smaller and smaller parts that rather than create this larger, more complex whole. Now, thinking about human beings in this way, as kind of built up in that way, it's in a sense just the last stage in a very long movement in Western thought. If you took some philosophy courses, you'd trace some of this movement in certain ways, in fact. First, we learned to think that qualities of objects were not really present in the objects themselves, but were supplied by the knowing subject. Then some philosophers suggested that the objects themselves, and not just their qualities, were simply constructs of the knowing subject, of the mind, human mind. But see, then we have to ask what happens when even that subject disappears. When that reductionistic process is applied also to the human subject, we get, as C.S. Lewis noted once in a rather witty passage, we get a result uncommonly like zero. While we were reducing the world to almost nothing, we deceived ourselves with the fancy that all its lost qualities were being kept safe, if in a somewhat humbled condition, as things in our mind. Apparently, we had no mind of the sort required. The subject is as empty as the object. Almost nobody has been making linguistic mistakes about almost nothing. By and large, this is the only thing that has ever happened. He's having a little fun there, but still he's capturing a certain sense of what that movement of thought has been about. In The Abolition of Man, Lewis strikingly depicts the movement by which things came to be understood, not sort of in their wholeness as organisms, but simply as parts of nature, objects that have no inherent purpose or telos in themselves, which objects can then become resources available for human use. And so, as Lewis puts it there, the long, slow process of conquering nature could more accurately be said to be reducing things to mere nature, in that sense. I'll read you a longer passage that from Abolition of Man. It writes, "We do not," he means anymore now, after this long thought, "we do not look at trees either as dryads or as beautiful objects while we cut them into beams. The first man who did so may have felt the price keenly, and the bleeding trees in Virgil and Spenser may be far-off echoes of that primeval sense of impiety. Every conquest over nature increases her domain. The stars do not become nature till we weigh and measure them. The soul does not become nature till we can psychoanalyze her." Updating him a little bit, we say, till we can sort of scan the synapses in the brain. "The wresting of powers from nature is also the surrendering of things to nature. As long as this process stops short of the final stage, we may hold that the gain outweighs the loss. But as soon as we take the final step of reducing our own species to the level of mere nature, the whole process is stultified. For this time, the being who stood to gain and the being who has been sacrificed are one and the same." Now, although my focus tonight, like Lewis's in that passage, is on what happens to human beings when we think of them simply as collections of genes, it's worth noting that that reductive understanding may be misplaced sometimes even when applied to lower creatures. I mean, Lewis says in the passage I quoted, you know, maybe it's useful until you get to the end point, and it is certainly sometimes, Lewis suggested in the passage that science does a kind of violence even to trees if we understand them only as natural objects. In our own day, we have gone well beyond the kind of quantitative reduction to parts that Lewis pictures here. We're on the brink of losing organisms altogether. When organisms become things lacking entirely any self-definition, then they become malleable and available for reprogramming and reshaping. Biological boundaries between organisms become historically contingent products of gradually accumulated change, and therefore those boundaries can be slightly breached with only slight consequences, or so we have come to think. Living beings, including human beings, become collections of bits of genetic information to be combined and recombined in countless possible ways. Now, at one time, we might have thought that the scientific attempt to understand the higher in terms of the lower was just that. It was a search to understand. And, of course, it is that, was that, and is that to some degree. But when we come to the point where we've come, we see that it's not just that. Sometimes, in some ways, wisdom, the search for wisdom and understanding gives way to power. See, now there may be nothing there to know except what we ourselves assemble and create. Genes are the resources we use in this creative process. Within the discipline of bioethics in this country, this approach will have its effect and has had its effect via a theory of justice. Here's the way it works. See, begin in this genetic age to think of human beings as constituted by their parts, built up from below, and you will find yourself thinking of genes as resources which may or may not be justly distributed. You might think about the just distribution of wealth or food or education or medical care. So also we might think of the bundles of genes that on this view constitute ourselves as simply another resource which may be distributed justly or unjustly. Again, if there are some political theorists out there, all that is John Rawls applied to bioethics. So that in an older way of thinking, there were human beings and there were resources. And we did justice or injustice to human beings by what we did with those resources. But now we will be invited to think of justice or injustice in the making of human beings, which is what we do when we distribute genetic resources. And in fact, going one step further, there will be no compelling reason to think that the genetic resources to be distributed need to be only DNA from the human species. Beings are simply creatures to be fashioned out of the available genetic resources. There will be no reason why you can't cross species boundaries in the of those resources. The only moral question will be whether the resources are fairly distributed. That's my first point. That's sort of the scientific way that we have begun to think about human beings as not so much as organisms, but as collections of parts. Now, what I want to do is suggest that this is not just a scientific way of thinking. It is that, of course. But that there's a sense in which this vision of life carries a deeper mythic dimension, and that we won't really sort of take in the measure of it unless we see it also in this way. So you have to be willing to sort of let your imaginations work with me here a little bit. We have to think in this way about ourselves, about human beings. It will still be true that somewhere back in the depths of that consciousness, which we will still imagine ourselves to have, we may detect a nagging worry. Who exactly are these beings who make decisions about how to distribute genetic resources? What entitles them? Those judgments. In a world devoid of any inherent value or purpose, in which organisms lack any self-definition, it's really not clear that we should be talking about justice or injustice. Why should we think some people wronged if they do not get a fair share of genetic endowments? That may be their misfortune, but what responsible agent has wronged them? Because in such a world, of course, we cannot blame God or even blame nature with a capital N any longer. So, you know, where exactly does that sort of language come from? Justice or injustice also can finally be nothing more than a construct that we impose, not only upon ourselves, but also upon those future generations whom we fashion from the genetic resources that we distribute. And we have, in fact, no more moral ground for anointing one particular distribution as just than another. What we have is creative power. That's what happens when we can no longer blame something higher, God or nature, for our condition. Of course, we are God. Or at least some of us. Suppose that neither God nor nature can any longer be held responsible for the future of the human condition, that we are creatively shaping that. And suppose that even though we don't think God or nature can be held responsible, we do still remain morally serious, not frivolous, and we think it matters how this distribution takes place. So that we believe that there's a moral difference in how genetic resources are distributed to future generations. Now, if neither God nor nature is available to, as it were, shoulder that moral burden, that responsibility, seriousness requires that somebody shoulder it, somebody take responsibility for it. Who remains as a likely candidate for such responsibility? I think humanity. Humanity conceived as godlike in its utterly free creative power and its responsibility for the future. The question that underlies this view of genes as resources is powerful and appealing in part, not only, but in part, precisely because of a very attractive mythic dimension that it carries. Rather than thinking of organisms simply as the result of an evolutionary process generated by natural selection, we can think of organisms, and especially certain kinds of organisms like us, as self-creators, constantly organizing and reorganizing themselves by reordering their genes. And in that sense, you see, genetic engineering, reshaping and reprogramming, genetic engineering is in accord with nature, nature understood as a continual exercise of our freedom, and reshape ourselves with no inherent limits other than those that we ourselves produce. If we miss that sort of powerful, mythic, quasi-religious dimension of this account, if we think of it simply as a neutral, scientific account of the universe, we're going to miss much of its appeal. We're going to miss much of the reason that it really draws us. Even if you think it's wrong, it's inadequate and not entirely satisfactory, as I think, you will still be drawn by it. You can't miss the lure of it in certain respects. So, for example, Lee Silver ends his book Remaking Eden, imagining some future generation after splicing and resplicing, combining and recombining of human genes has taken place over generations. He imagines some future generation of creatures whom he calls simply, for shorthand, gen-rich creatures, the ones who... the rich genetic inheritance. Creatures for whom Homo sapiens were simply a distant ancestor. Okay, but they've point that they're not really the same species precisely any longer. And then he writes, Silver's a scientist. Curious, hard-nosed. So he thinks hard-nosed. He writes, these beings have dedicated their long lives to answering three deceptively simple questions that have been asked in every self-conscious generation of the past. Where did the universe come from? Why is there something rather than nothing? And what is the meaning of conscious existence? Now, as the answers are upon them, they find themselves coming face to face with their creator. What do they see? Is it something that 20th century humans, he was writing very late 20th century, is it something that 20th century humans can't possibly fathom in their wildest imaginations? Or is it simply their own image in the mirror as they reflect themselves back to the beginning of time? They found their creator, you see. Now, for the moment about whether that's true or not. Not science. It's myth, you see. And it's alluring and powerful. It draws us. Because it is. It could not possibly appeal to us as powerfully as it does were it not for that mythic dimension. It's not just a cold theory at all. It's something much more than that. And as a kind of myth, it invites our sustained attention and critique. That is to say, we need to take that dimension of this way of picturing human beings seriously. We need to think about what sorts of moral commitments it involves for us if we really do take it seriously. That's what I want to do for a moment. I want to just talk very briefly about three different sort of implications of this myth of human beings as creators. First, and most important, this myth is radically dualistic. When genes become resources and organisms lack self-definition, they become amenable to indefinite reprogramming. As I said before, human beings contented themselves with the pleasant thought that we were the subjects who objectified and constructed the rest of the world. However, we also become constructs as our genes are spliced and exchanged. But then, who is doing the program? Project, are we? Clearly, there's a ghost in the machine somewhere, as dualists have always believed. We are both programmer and programmed, both manufactured body and ethereal manufacturer. And where do those two meet? Well, we can't really say. But it appears that the real self can hardly be a body. For the body can be shaped and reshaped indefinitely as we distribute genetic resources. So the initial dualism is metaphysical. In what we're often inclined to describe as a sort of a materialistic age, it turns out that the real self, since bodily form is indefinitely malleable, the real self, that powerful, creative, ordering intelligence, is not material. It must be something different. So that for any future our impoverished imaginations can conceive, that real self probably still needs a body as a kind of beachhead in our world, a mode of entry, means we cannot fathom. But the body is finally mere natural object. The real self, the creative, constructive self, will have to find elsewhere, somewhere else. The end of the dualism, were that all that it amounted to, or we could say, were it merely an idea, it would do little harm. We tend to, except for hardcore academicians, we tend to think that ideas by themselves aren't really all that important. But the truth is that ideas have a way of taking shape in life. And if sheer metaphysical dualism of self and body cannot really be lived, those who think in its terms will need some more vulgar translation. And in place of the dualism that separates the ghost in the machine from the body, will come the dualism that separates some human beings, programmers, from other human beings, programmed. And again, I mean, we have to try to think through the vision and take it seriously. Who will undertake to design our future descendants? Midgley writes, it cannot be the human race as a whole. They wouldn't know how to do it. It has to be the elite, the biotechnologists, who are the only people able to make these changes. So it emerges that members of the public who complain that biotechnological projects involve playing God have in fact understood this claim correctly. That phrase, which defenders of the project have repeatedly dismissed as mere mumbo-jumbo, is actually a quite exact term for the sort of claim to omniscience and omnipotence on these matters that is being put forward. Fascinating passage from a woman, Mary Midgley, who's a philosopher, thinks strictly as a philosopher, and says, you know, those sort of simple religious folk who've criticized this biotechnological project as playing God, the truth is they're exactly right. That's the exactly correct description of what, in fact, is going on, as this dualism between the programmers and the programmed, the present generation and the future generation, future generations, works itself out. So that the very first moral casualty of this dualism is human equality in the relation between the generations. He is, in effect, echoing the point made by C.S. Lewis in The Abolition of Man a half century earlier, when he wrote in that passage I read before, each new power won by man is a power over man. Well, that's the first thing, just the dualism of the picture. But there's a second thing to notice about this myth, and that is how powerfully religious it really is. Not in institutional ways, of course, but in other ways. It may be good to remember to advert to a body of literature that C.S. Lewis was very interested in and worked a long time on in some ways. It may be good to remember that when the magician Merlin makes his first appearance in English literature and history, in Geoffrey of Monmouth's 12th century work, History of the Kings of England, Merlin is both a magician and an engineer. In the Kingdom of Britain, Geoffrey writes, there is no one more skilled either in the foretelling of the future or in mechanical contrivances. The engineer. So it's Merlin who, on the one hand, oversees and enables, I mean, according to the legend, who oversees and enables the engineering marvel of moving to Britain the rocks from Stonehenge. Geoffrey credits that to Merlin. It is also Merlin who magically disguises King Uther Pendragon so that, seeming to be the Duke of Cornwall, he may sleep with the Duke's wife, Egerna, by whom then Arthur, the great King Arthur, is conceived. Merlin is also the magician who does that. So that powerful capacity to engineer and reconstruct is intimately related to the magician's desire to tap into power more than human. For precisely that reason, genuine science that doesn't want, you know, to fall into that power must always be governed by a sense of limits. We should not underestimate how deeply this desire for a godlike power infects our humanity. After all, central to stories that go very deep into our tradition for religious believers and those who aren't religious believers, stories like the fall of Adam and Eve into sin, story like the story of Prometheus. And because this desire, which is ultimately a desire not simply for understanding, but for power, infects all of us so deeply, we do well to anticipate that even the most altruistic of our projects may be corrupted by it. When a religious quest goes bad, after all, that something really goes bad. A religious quest that goes bad becomes demonic. In the sense that we can treat our genes as resources, be combined and recombined indefinitely, has been called algeny. Jeremy Rifkin. And algeny is a name intended to remind us of alchemy. And alchemy was a quest. Again, combined the scientific urge and a quest to transform base metals into gold. It was scientific was religious character. If we do not see these connections, then we miss the human meaning of what is happening in genetic advance. And we fail to see how the thirst that drives and underlies the bioengineering project is not only of great benefit to human beings, but may also be dangerous, because it seeks not only understanding, but also power. A third characteristic of this great vision, not only dualistic and religious in character, but this mythic vision of genes as resources, this sense that we might have within our very near within our grasp a power over the secret of life, is also utopian. And what I mean by that is this: the project of human improvement, of overcoming suffering and enhancing human capacities, it has no logical stopping point. There will always be another disease to overcome, more years to be added to life, points to be added to the intelligence quotient, even at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. It will still be true that can be done. Jeremy Rifkin, who, as I said, was largely responsible for popularizing the term allogeny, has noted how the alchemical quest, the alchemists, the medieval alchemists, their quest was to help nature in its struggle to perfect itself. It's that perfection that is that utopian desire. Cooperating with a nature understood to have only very fluid boundaries between organisms, treating genes as resources to be combined in ever new and better ways, we place our hope and, in a sense, our virtue in the future. What makes it utopian? If that perfected future never comes, or if it comes and turns out to be marked more by power than by wisdom, then we will have to be justified only by our good intentions, and I'm not sure those will be sufficient to justify us. I'm not sure they'll be adequate for the task. And now third and last, which does not mean be done in a minute, though not actually very long. This will be briefer than the other two, if only because, as I said at the start, there are just limits to what I can say here, you know, and I'd be glad if someone could do better. But what I want to think about is whether there is not a replacement way, because, I mean, we do need this scientific way of thinking about human beings to some degree, but whether there's another more holistic way to think about human beings that we also need to protect us against the dangers of the one image taken all by itself. Sketched out does not sound like a necessarily desirable path into the future, then we might want to rethink that image of genes as pages in a loose leaf book to be transferred and combined at will, which means rethink the meaning of our humanity, what an organism really is. On a very different issue, well, maybe not very different, but at least different, writing about human embryo research, Courtney Campbell once contrasted terms of reproduction and thinking in terms of procreation. The contrast is not actually original with him, but he contrasted them in order to make a point that's not unlike the one that I've been making in a different context. See, when we speak of reproduction, we're likely to think of genes as the building blocks of life, and of the person as conceived, as it were, from the genes up, as Campbell put it. And the embryo then is just a cluster of dividing cells, those collections of parts that will result in something else. But quite often, as Courtney Campbell noted, that sort of angle of vision can detach reproduction from its larger human context and from the meaning and purposiveness that find in procreation. So that reductionistic thinking about the embryo turns out to subvert the primary ethical reason for engaging in research on the embryo, because that reason is to advance human purposes, and yet we've trained ourselves to think of human beings in a way that doesn't make purposes integral to who they are and what they do. So that we need that purposiveness to explain why we're doing what we're doing, and yet the way we've begun to think entirely empties our vision of purpose and meaning. And the question is now whether we can at least begin to contemplate other, more satisfactorily human ways of thinking about our humanity. As I said, what I have to say here is going to be very inadequate, but it may at least sort of suggest how one might begin thinking in different ways. It's certainly not original with me. In fact, I'm going to draw very specifically on an illustration that I do take from C.S. Lewis in just a second. But here's the point. Rather than understanding the human being, the higher organism, in terms of what is lower, we might try to recapture a way of thinking that begins with what is higher and does not think of human beings as collections of bits of genetic information. To take the longer context for that passage from Stephen Jay Gould that I read at the start, it came from an essay. It comes from an essay he wrote when the findings of the Genome Project were announced. And he wrote, "The key to complexity, the kind of complexity that the key to complexity is not more genes, but more combinations and interactions generated by fewer units of code. And many of these interactions, as emergent properties, to use the technical jargon, must be explained at the level of their appearance, for they cannot be predicted from the separate underlying parts alone. So organisms must be explained as organisms, and not as a summation of genes." To say, if we insist on starting from below in thinking about our human nature, we'll accomplish some useful things. You know, it'll be good for certain purposes. But we will also miss much of the depth of the human person, of what it means to be a human being. Imagine, for instance, I take this example from... Imagine if you were going to try to translate from one language to another, and you were going to try to translate from a language which was a very rich, language, a large, subtle, varied vocabulary, and you were going to try to translate from that language into another language with a much smaller, much less varied, much less nuanced vocabulary. From the much richer language to the much poorer language. Just imagine yourself having to do that. How could one do that? Well, by giving more than one sense to words in the language into which we're translating. You know, the words in that relatively poor, simple language are going to have to do double, triple, quadruple duty in various ways to do justice to all the nuances that the more complex language has. And, of course, it's true, you see, that as you tried to do that, a speaker of that poorer language, a speaker who knew only the poorer language, who was starting from below, sense, might obstinately insist when you took some word in his language and used it in various different contexts to try to do justice to the nuances of the more complex language, speaker of that language might obstinately insist, no, that's not the right way to use this word. Only use it in one way, as far as he's concerned. He would be approaching the richer language from below, as if the richer language could be made up simply of words drawn from the limits of his own less subtle language, used only in the ways that he's accustomed to using them. Not be able to persuade him that he was mistaken or wrong, but he would also be cut off from certain insights, you see. If there were certain kind of insights built into the nuances of that richer language, and if he insisted obstinately on refusing to kind of try to meet it, but to look only from below, there would be certain things that he finally just wouldn't be able to see or understand. He would be sort of confined to the limits of his world. It's a very different illustration, but one that is common, I think, in human experience. A man in love with a woman and a man lusting after a woman experience many of the same physiological symptoms. You know, it's if you're going to reduce it to physiological symptoms, the two experiences may, in many respects, be the same. If we have never been in love, or if we insist on acting as if we have never been in love, if, that is, we persist in looking at the experience only from below, only in terms of its physiological symptoms, we might argue that there was no difference between love and lust. Its component parts, you see, the two experiences might be more or less the same. So the theory that a man would be too wise to enunciate as he whispered in her ear might seem a compelling thesis for a scholarly essay. Only someone who began from above, who really knew what it was to be in love, would see at once that these experiences are not the same, accounted for simply in those reductionistic terms. If, however, we insist that we must start from below, if we insist that love must be analyzed and understood entirely in terms of those physiological symptoms, well, then once again, we cut ourselves off from an entire realm of human wisdom and experience. Perhaps no one can prove you're wrong. There are also certain things that you just can't experience. We will never know what it means to be in love. If you insist on thinking in that way, then you can neither have nor understand Romeo's experience when he first sets eyes on Juliet. Ah, she doth teach the torches to burn bright. It's just a flutter in the stomach, you know, and various things, that's all. So that were we really to try to think of human beings from above, to eschew at least for certain and certain purposes reductionistic modes of thought, then it would be no surprise. We wouldn't be surprised at all if we were to learn that the relative richness of human life is not simply a matter of our having more genes than other organisms. It's only surprising if you start from below. Thinking from above, we would stop thinking about human beings as collections of resources which it was our duty to distribute in creatively fashioning the next generation. We would be protected at least somewhat against thinking of our relation to future generations chiefly as an exercise of power in the making and remaking of humanity, even if that power is cloaked in the language of a theory of justice. In short, if we were at least to some degree to learn to master the genies who invite us to think and desire in certain ways, then we would have far less to fear from the ongoing attempt to master our genes. Thank you very much.
Professor Mylander is open to responding to questions and comments from you. While he is doing that, some folks will be passing among you with some cards. If you would like to fill them out, that will give us an opportunity not only to get some response from you, but for those of you who would like to be added to our mailing list and receive publicity about next year, that will give us an opportunity to receive that from you. But here he is.
Is that so? What? What did you do? Okay. Handful, actually. The one thing I have to say, which actually probably will not seem satisfactory to you, but seems to me the thing to say, is that I don't believe that I'm the one who talked about genes in this way. I believe I've simply picked up a rather common way of thinking about them. The loose leaf pages isn't something I made up. It's a quote from a biologist, okay? Not from a literature scholar or a philosopher or anything like that, but from a biologist. So that, always open to suggestions that greater complexity is needed, and no doubt it is, though you might not have wanted it, actually. But all I'd say is that this way of thinking, which I do not think, which I think is becoming increasingly common, seems to me not to be something that I particularly dreamed up, and it seems to me, in fact, to be a way that scientists themselves have taught us to think to some degree. So that's the one thing. Now, your other questions take us a little different. Searle is just so complicated that I don't know for sure what I want to say about him. Dawkins is an interesting example of what I think is a certain kind of... not unfair to use the word reductionistic in some ways, that you see, in terms of my projects in the world and your projects in the world, that can really be explained at some fundamental level by our genes trying to perpetuate themselves. That's a sort of a classic example of thinking of the human being from below. It may be useful for some purposes, okay? There are certain kinds of mating patterns that why people with certain recessive genes seem so seldom to mate, for instance. It may be it's useful to explain in some ways. But if we thought it could explain entirely some fundamental elements of human experience like that of love that I talked about at the end, I think it would be an inadequate and, in some respects, debased human being as human being. Yes. I'll reformulate this question to, something I want to answer. No, I'll do my best to do justice to it. He wanted to know. He began by asking about sort of discourse in Washington about related issues and Nancy Reagan's plea for stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research, and wondering whether we couldn't think of such efforts as simply medicinal or therapeutic, I guess you mean, in nature, rather than as a sort of a process of recreating ourselves, or the kinds of language I used. I think one thing to say is that, in a certain sense, I believe I was thinking about a slightly different issue that way is finally more fundamental even than the public argument about embryonic stem cell research. The arguments about specific issues like that are very important, and I'm actually happy to talk about them at some length if you wish. What I was trying to get at was something even more basic about a sort of image of the human being is arising, and that we ourselves have learned to think in. Now, it does relate to your particular question, though. There's a lot more to say about embryonic stem cell research than just this, but at some deep level, I myself think the mental urge to relieve suffering, which is always the primary justification. Oh, I mean, why would you do this? I mean, the attempt to relieve suffering in generations, that fundamental urge is, as I put it at that one point, utopian in this sense, that it never comes to an end. See? And what I myself think To relieve suffering is a kind of God. It gets you in its grip, and you either break the grip or it holds you. And in our culture, it's very hard because that language of compassion is very old Christian language. The way it's gotten used is really Nietzsche's stench of Christian moralism, actually. But it's very powerful for us. But Christians never thought that relief of suffering was the highest good. They thought it was a very important good, but didn't mean that it had moral trump in the sense that any and every possible means to it were to be used. So that even if we step back from those deeper philosophical waters that I was trying to draw us into, and we just say, well, here's a possible therapy, what should we think about it? Might lead to great good, might lead to relief of suffering. We still have to ask, by what means, at what moral price, you see. Not every good should be realized by every possible means, necessarily. And so we'd have to ask, what are we doing in embryonic stem cell research? Is what we're doing there acceptable, or is there something wrong with it? If there's something wrong with it, then we might have to say, well, if this is a good we want to pursue, we'll have to find other ways to pursue it. So simply pointing to the fact that there's a possible therapeutic use, possible relief of suffering, doesn't answer all the moral questions we are going to have to ask about how we go about trying to reach that end. Think so. In fact, I mean, the standard way of thinking is that they're that much difference. You see, that's what makes human complexity such a puzzle in need of explanation. We share a large portion of our genetic inheritance with the other animals. Of our genes, but there is an intelligible sense. I mean, I realize it's arguable, we can argue, but there's an intelligible sense in which the human being might be said to be a higher organism than a roundworm. And what it has to do is precisely with some kind of organismal complexity that's there. And the question is how you account for that. I don't know if it's based on biology, but it certainly need not be based on religion. I mean, the human species has characteristics and capacities that seem to be of considerably greater complexity than the roundworm has. I mean, subject to correction, maybe I'm just missing something. I don't think you have to be religious to see that. Are you hearing him? What he wants to know is, tell me if I do justice to your question, is if we have someone who is profoundly retarded and who therefore lacks and probably always will lack some of the characteristically higher capacities that make Homo sapiens Homo sapiens, whether that profoundly retarded person is, he said, better. I'm not quite sure that's the right word, but somehow has less claim on us in a certain way than chimpanzee, say, or a dolphin, maybe something like that. And he has no grasp of morality. certain contexts, again, and arguable questions. So it's not as if someone can't disagree with what I'm about to answer you, okay? They'll give you the answer I'm about to give you if I didn't think it were the truth. All right. But it's not, but you shouldn't suppose that just because I tell you what I think the truth is, I don't know that people couldn't disagree with it. There are certain kinds of capacities and characteristics that distinguish the human species from the other animals. To be a human being, or to be a member of the human species, with the rights and dignities that we think, at any rate, members of the human species have, you do not have to have or to be exercising yourself those characteristic capacities. You simply have to be born of human parents. Okay, so that we have to make a distinction between the distinguishing characteristics of the species, the way you become a member of the species. And you don't necessarily become a member of the species by having all those characteristics or having them in some, up to some level or something like that. You have it by being a human being, born of human parents. And that's why even the weakest and most disadvantaged and most vulnerable of human beings still have a claim on us for equal care, it seems to me. That doesn't mean that the chimpanzee has no claim on us in any way, but not the same kind of claim that a member of Homo sapiens have. So the better language, I don't quite know, but I would say that however profoundly retarded your brother were, for instance, we have obligations to him, and he has claims on us that we have only to human beings. What do you mean by superiority? I don't mind the superiority language, but you'd started with superior genes, and that's where we were. Yeah, but is superiority from some angles doesn't seem to me to be objectionable. I've obviously been willing to talk about human beings as in some sense higher than others, so that. Senses, that means superiority. That doesn't answer the question, though, about what ways are appropriate and what ways are inappropriate for higher beings to make use of lower beings. See, we still have a whole bunch of issues we'll have to talk about. Is it okay to eat them? Eat animals, for instance? Well, I mean, I think it is, but talk about it, you know, why. So the simple fact that we've got a kind of hierarchy at work doesn't solve all the other questions that may arise. Did you hear him? Oh, okay. I always forget that, and then I just think I should. He wants to know, with respect to kind of making changes in the genome, whether the simple fact that we can it means that we should. Okay. I think the first thing to say, at least in the moral world that I inhabit, is not obvious that it would mean that. That is to say, there may well be things that we can do, but we ought not. I mean, at least in the moral world I inhabit, there are some things that it's quite possible we can do. I mean, just forget biotechnology entirely. Think about the things we could do in waging war, for instance. There are some things that we can do that we ought not. I mean, we could just obliterate cities, for instance. We have on a couple occasions, of course. As a general principle, it's not true that, I don't think it's true that anything that we can do, we ought to. Though, to go on to say, if do something and it looks as if it could get something that we really, the temptation to do it will be very strong and very powerful. circumstances in which there's no problem. I mean, roughly speaking, the way the genetic alteration has gotten talked about is this, that there are some sorts of genetic changes that, to the degree that we could do them, would be therapeutic, gene therapy of various kinds. I myself think of that as simply an extension of traditional medicine. It's the traditional medicine's therapeutic effort with new ways of seeking it out. Well, just let me finish the thought, and then I'll let you. Though it hasn't been very successful, actually, up till now. There are also possibilities of doing what generally gets called, the language doesn't quite work, but enhancing human nature, enhancing human capacities through, one means would be through genetic changes. That's, I think, a more problematic project to embark on. It certainly knows no end, and I would certainly not say that simply because we can do it, we ought to. Now, you wanted a clarification?
Yeah.
A good qualification. What he basically pointed to is that even if we say, okay, enhancement's a separate matter, we're not going to talk about that, we're just going to talk about therapy, genetic therapy could take two forms. They're generally called somatic and germline therapy. One could simply alter the soma of a particular person, the body of a particular person, make a change in that person's existence, which change would not be passed on to any of his or her descendants. That's what I was talking about when I said it seems to me that that's largely just an extension of traditional medicine. Much more complicated and is, if it were possible, it's not clear it's possible in human beings right now anyway, though something like it's been done in mice, would be germline therapy, in which an alteration in the germ cells, the gametes themselves, would be made, which alteration then would be passed on to all future descendants of that that person. And that is different and needs a different kind of thought, because clearly there's a certain sense in which you could say at that point that the patient then has become not this individual human being, but the species. And that does begin to open up some of the kinds of worries that I was coming at from a rather different way in my talk. There are some complications and complexities there, but I would think that there was a lot of reason to worry and draw back from that possibility. She alluded to reports that Chinese scientists have already produced some entities that combine genetic materials from human beings and other species, producing hybrids or chimeras of some sort, and wanted to know what I thought about that. Well, I think it's probably a bad idea. We don't always know for sure what's happening among Chinese researchers, but it's clear that not just in China but elsewhere there is a push toward production of certain kinds of hybrids for research purposes right now, anyway, not in order to, as it were, gestate and bring them to birth, but for research purposes. Complicated questions that need thinking about there. It could be that there'd be some kinds of hybridization that are not problematic, that don't involves such a mixing of genes that, as it were, the kind of organization of the other species is taken over, the kind of organic self-definition is taken over by the other genetic materials. And there could be others that are really true hybrids, in a sense, that would be very troubling, that we wouldn't quite even know what we wanted to talk about. What we ought to conclude from that, I think, rather than sort of, I mean, I've got my own view sort of on, but rather than trying to exactly to answer the question, what we ought to conclude is that this is not something that science should simply be free to proceed on, unhindered and unhampered. This is the way things so often happen. You wake up one morning, you look at the paper, and you see this guy, Ian Wilmot, cloned a sheep. Fact of our world, with which we must all come to terms. You wake up one morning and you read the folks at ACT Technology cloned a human embryo. They only divided it to 4 or 8 cells, however it was, but they did it. This is now a fact of our world that we must live with. What we really need are extensive moratoria. A shifting of the burden of proof, not necessarily saying, because we got things that we still need to sort out, not necessarily saying this is something that we want to say for all time should never be done. No, there may be some things about which we'd want to say that, but saying that this is the public should have an opportunity to think this through and not just be confronted after the fact with an advance, if we want to consider it an advance. That's our problem right now, is that we have been able to muster the will to say to be stopped for a time, not attempted for a time, until we've managed to sort out what we really think it's okay to do and what we think ever be doing that in our society.
For those for whom 9/20 is an apocalyptic moment,
well,
perhaps one more, and
okay,
then we should.
That's good. I count myself among those. Who's the lucky person up there?
Yes.
Wants to know kind of how we deal with the possibility of bad consequences in making these decisions. Is that it? Say a couple things. It's true to say that the views that I hold, you just magically want to hold them. You know, if you all left here tonight saying, "My, that was persuasive." I certainly want to think that way myself in the future. The views that I hold would slow certain kinds of research. Okay, we would not necessarily rule out, but we would slow them and place impediments in the way till we thought certain things through and were more certain about some things. And therefore, someone who holds the kind of view that I hold might well seize upon the possibility of bad consequences as one argument for slowing down. Okay, and there's something to that. There's a lot to it. I hesitate to make too much of it, though, in a couple senses. One is, I wouldn't ask of researchers, even though I want to slow them down, I wouldn't ask of researchers a kind of certainty that I don't think human life affords. They have to give us as much certainty as they can, but I would not, you know, life does not provide absolute certainty, and so if something went wrong, while I might purpose at some point say, now you see, we needed to be more careful. I don't think I'd say that just shows you that in and of itself, all by itself, that the project was mistaken, because we're human beings and we're fallible. And even in endeavors to which I think there's no moral objection, things can go wrong after all. So that I just want to be, it's a serious matter, it should be taken seriously, and we have certainly, there are certain things, for instance, in the assisted area of what we call assisted reproduction today, certain ways in which we've gone ahead with in clinical medicine without really much testing in advance at all and worrying about the consequences. We should be more careful. I'd want to be cautious about how strongly I made the argument. The other thing I'd say is that, for me at least, and for all of you who are going to leave so persuaded by it, the whole of the moral argument does not depend on whether the consequences will be good or bad. And by that I mean that certain kinds of advance, it seems to me possible that there might be things that genuinely would produce beneficial results, but would produce them by means which I think are morally wrong. And so the simple fact that they'll produce good rather than bad consequences does not settle the moral argument as far as I'm concerned. There are questions about the goods we want to seek. There are questions about the right and wrong ways of seeking them. Those are two separate moral questions. And we have to keep the distinction between them clearly in mind. So the simple fact of good consequences does not mean that I say full speed ahead. And therefore, I don't want to make the entire argument against certain kinds of things rest only on the possibility of bad consequences.
Once again, in thanking Professor Mylander.
Thank you.